Welcome back to the Caught Red podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jesse Light.
I'm Megan Light.
We are just two dog lovers talking about true crime, horror movies, and most likely our dogs too. We hope everybody had a happy Thanksgiving. I know we did.
No drama for your mama.
No drama. I like that. We went to my parents' house on Wednesday and stuffed our faces.
Played a game called Smartass. I liked it. That was fun.
You liked it because you kept winning.
You're right.
Mom said they played the next day or the next day after that. I don't know, but she won twice.
Good for her.
She was on the struggle bus with us, but it's because Megan was dominating the whole time. Then on Thanksgiving, we went to Megan's side of the family. And there was a lot more people at that one.
I thought it was funny, though, how my family, like us, we kind of like kept to ourselves. Like we had our own table.
Yeah.
And didn't socialize with the rest of my family for the majority of the time.
We did, but at the same time, yeah.
We did it, yeah.
Yeah. The kids had their own table, and then we always sit by the kids, but
it's the big kids' table.
I think we were louder than them.
Yeah.
But I had my sports ball on.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
So, of course, I was watching the Detroit Lions, which is Megan's mom's favorite team, even though she couldn't care less about football, but that's just where she's from, Michigan, so.
She loves from afar.
Yes.
For different reasons.
Yes. We didn't watch any horror movies this past week, at least none that are worthy to talk about, but we did watch Equalizer 3. Which I thought was the best one out of all three.
I was physically present because I was reading.
My dad's been telling me that I need to watch it. I need to watch it over and over again. And finally,
it's Denzel. We had the chance. You were going to watch it eventually.
Yeah. Love Denzel. Great movie. You got any book recommendations? I know you've read like five since last week.
I was going to save them.
Okay. For another time?
Yeah. Next week. Because I need to get a couple more in under my belt before I talk about some.
Yeah.
And it was just last week I talked about like six, so I'll give them a break.
Bet. I was on the way back from bringing our trash bin in and ran into our neighbor and we were talking and he's getting closer and closer to starting his podcast / YouTube channel. I'm excited about that. He was showing me the shed that he bought, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he's making it into his studio. It's getting there. Looking good.
That's what we need.
I can't wait to see
like
the finished product, but I can't wait to shout him out whenever that time comes. But and then I got one more shout out to Kortzmeyer Music came out with a song today.
Oh yeah. What is it?
And that's of course our friends that made our intro music, we've talked about them before. It is called Before. So go check them out on Spotify. It's Kortzmeyer Music, Kortzmeyer Music. They're really good. If you like country music. Other than that, Megan's got our episode today. It is, well, there's a book about it. Right? Same.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'll let you talk about it. So go
ahead.
It's fine. It's fine.
No, it's fine.
I know nothing about it except for Anita Paddock.
That's right. I have her book called Cold Blooded that I referenced quite a bit. And then I had some other sources like the Fort Smith Times Record, FortSmithHistory.org, Officer Down Memorial Page, Case Text, and Find a Grave. I'm coming back home to Arkansas this week to the beginning of the 1980s.
It's been a minute since you've done an Arkansas case.
Yeah, it has. And it's not too far in time or distance from the story Jesse told us back in episode 54. Just a reminder of what that one was. Do you want to give a little lowdown?
Put me on the spot.
I did.
Shit.
So His episode 54 for that happened September of 1980 in Van Buren, Arkansas. Lowdown is one of the thieves just wanted to rob the store, but his partner crime took it a step further. And if you recall, Jesse mentioned a book he had read. It's called Closing Time by Miss Anita Paddock.
It was a really good book. And I wouldn't have been able to find.
Yes, exactly. 80% That's of why this I was so glad she her, had yeah. this book for this episode. Anita is from the town of Van Buren. She has a love for books. And so she combined those two parts of her life into one by becoming a true crime writer, focusing on murders that happened in and around her hometown.
That could be you one day.
I know. How exciting. I'm going to tell you all about the 1981 murders of four people in Fort Smith. And just to give you an idea of the proximity, Fort Smith and Van Buren are about 15 minutes apart from one another. And I hadn't even heard about these murders until her book. Besides this one and Closing Time, she's written a couple other books. One is Blind Rage and the other is Killing Spree. And I'm not going to go into those because I think one of us would probably end up doing one of them or both of them.
They sound exciting though.
Killing Spree takes place in the mid-70s in Fort Smith. Blind Rage is in Van Buren, and it's about the murder of an older woman in 1981, which makes you kind of wonder what was up with the water in Northwest Arkansas during that time period, because when you think about it, in the quiet town of Van Buren and in the Fort Smith area, there was two dead in 1980 and then five in 1981, all within months of each other. It's just so strange to think about. You ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
The morning of January 5th, 1981 was just like any other Monday morning for Juwanna Price while she was on Christmas break from school. Juwanna was currently a nursing student in her last semester at West Ark, which was Fort Smith Community College, which now it's called the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith. Ever since she was a young girl, Juwanna had dreamt of becoming a nurse. She locked her rotations in pediatrics, psychology, and the ICU. She had five more days until she was back to hit the books and back in school. But she was thankful that she was given a part-time job to pass the time and bring in a little extra money for her and her husband, Larry. She and Larry had been high school sweethearts and very much opposites. He was tall, she was short, she was shy, he wasn't. They just clicked and they were together ever since. They got married in 1978. That morning, while she got ready for work, Larry had been out on a test drive with a man. The car was a 1979 Ford LTD, silver and maroon in color, and it wasn't the Price's car. It belonged to their friend Holly Gentry, and Holly Gentry was one of the owners of their apartment complex called Glen Holly, and Juwanna and Larry were really good friends with Holly, and Holly ended up making Larry and Juwanna the apartment's managers. Holly had also been the one to suggest that Juwanna go for this part-time secretary job at the Phoenix Village Mall. Juwanna was just about done getting dressed when she heard voices in the living room. Larry and the man had returned. When she left the bedroom, she was informed by her husband that this man wanted to buy Holly Gentry's car. The man looked a bit worn down, his appearance not quite what she had imagined, but, you know, whatever. Juwanna and the man exchanged pleasantries. Larry walked Juwanna out to her orange Ford Maverick, which is a beautiful car, and the version they made for modern times is...
Really?
Yeah, they made it into like a little truck.
Aw.
They discussed their lunch plans for the day. Larry said that he would pick her up at noon. They said their goodbyes, and Juwanna headed to work, and Larry went back inside to finish the deal. Only things don't go as planned. Juwanna Price would have never guessed that this would have been the last time that she would see or speak to her husband. Juwanna arrived at work promptly, 5 minutes till nine, like she did every day. The Phoenix Village Mall was owned by Holly Gentry's family and the Morris family, which is just another nice family that lived in Fort Smith. The two of the families were from small country towns and they built lives for themselves. Holly himself had a store in the mall called Sueyville, and it sold Razorback-themed items. And if you guys don't know, Arkansas may not be the best in sports, but our fans are just something else. They're very loyal no matter if we win or we lose.
Woo, pig suey.
Yep. Juwanna saw Holly and let him know that Larry went with a man that very morning on a test drive and that his car was more than likely being sold as they spoke. Yes, Holly's a man, by the way.
I was about to ask.
His mother named him after one of her favorite, like, cowboy characters. Lunchtime was approaching. Juwanna was outside the mall's offices waiting for Larry, and she waited and waited. When she went back inside 45 minutes later, Holly just assumed she was returning from a nice lunch with her husband, but her face told a different story. She said Larry didn't pick her up, but instead of being angry with him, she said she was worried. Juwanna called her and Larry's neighbor to see if she wouldn't mind knocking on the door to check in on Larry. The neighbor did not, and a few minutes later she dialed back to let Juwanna know that there was no answer, but Larry's car was in the parking lot and the car that he was selling was gone. Juwanna worried that something had happened with his parents, so she tried calling Larry's parents next, but he wasn't there either. Juwanna tried his work next, and the receptionist there said a man had called to let them know that Larry wouldn't be in that day. Now Juwanna was really starting to worry, and she thought back to that mysterious man, the worn down looking one that was standing in her living room just hours earlier.
Definitely, if Larry didn't call in sick, if some other random man called in sick for him, that's
what's going on.
Suspicious.
Thomas Simmons had always had a plan. He knew exactly what he was going to do once he set up the time to see the car that he found in the newspaper's ad. But, like always, there was a monkey wrench thrown into that plan. Larry Price's wife was home, a witness, someone who could potentially recognize him. See, Thomas Simmons was never going to buy that car. He was going to just take it. He had planned to go on this test drive, dump Larry in the middle of God knows where, and then flip it and sell it to this other guy he knew as John for like $1,500. Thomas decided to lie and say that his wife wanted to see the car and minded if Larry let him drive it to Central Mall, just another mall in Fort Smith, to show her. But of course, Larry's like, hey, it's not my car. I don't want to let it out of my sight. And Larry, being the nice guy that he was, said, I don't mind going with you as long as we're back before noon so I can take my wife to lunch. But obviously, that's not what Mr. Thomas Simmons had planned in his mind. So Thomas said, you know what? Come on, let's take that ride. And as he said that, he pulled a pistol from his jacket. Larry, trying to remain calm, told Thomas to go ahead and just take the car. But Thomas knew that it wouldn't end like that. Larry would just have to come with him. Gun in hand, Thomas told Larry to get in the car and drive. Thomas had Larry drive just outside the city of Fort Smith between Van Buren and Alma.
Can't trust anybody you meet on Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, just like Bobby Joe Long from last week's episode, trying to get furniture and used appliances and stuff like that, and meeting girls who are home alone, and you know the rest.
Larry was instructed to stop at Clear Creek Park, and that's where he started to panic. They were all alone. The worst feeling came over him, and he started to plead for his life. Thomas told Larry to get out, and he tied him up with cord that he had in his pocket. Thomas kept repeating, I'm not going to kill you. I'll just leave you here. But then the men walked further and further. Larry was still pleading for his life. And moments later, Thomas grabbed a hold of Larry's jacket collar, pulling it up as high as he could. He placed the pistol next to it and pulled the trigger. Thomas fired one shot into the back of Larry's head. Then he went back to the now stolen car and wiped it down. He drove back into the city to go to a branch of a bank called Citizen Bank. He walked up to the teller and asked to deposit a check, one that he had forged with Larry's signature. Now, when Larry walked Juwanna out earlier that morning, Thomas acted like he was calling his wife And that's when he looked around and he saw a checkbook and couldn't help himself. Back at the offices of the Phoenix Village Mall, Juwanna and Holly are both worried about Larry. Holly offered to drive to the apartments and double check, which he did, and confirm what the neighbor had told Juwanna. The two of them decided to go to the Fort Smith police station and explain what was going on.
It shouldn't take long for the police to put the pieces together on that, follow the breadcrumbs, especially with that check.
We'll get to that. They ended up in the office of Detective James Poncho Davis. I call him Poncho during this.
Cool.
And Detective Ray Tate. The detectives inquired about the basics, description, age, workplace, etc. Juwanna is adamant that something is wrong because she told the detectives that this would be the last time before she returned to school that she and Larry could have lunch together, and he wasn't going to miss that. Before they could ask if she thought he could be cheating, Juwanna told them about the man. She described him as being in his 40s and skinny. He had thinning brown hair and he wore glasses. He had these sideburns and a mustache and he just looked dirty. He and Larry were still discussing the LTD when she left the apartment at 8:40 that morning. Holly butted in saying it was all his fault because that was his car he had asked Larry to sell for him. He was feeling guilty already. The detectives put an APB out on the car, but they needed the VIN number and the license plate. Juwanna said that all the paperwork that they needed was back at the apartment. Detective Tate agreed to go with Juwanna and Holly back to the apartment for the information and finish the report. Detective Poncho said he had a meeting and he would catch up with Tate later.
Poncho, the head honcho.
I love that name, Poncho. He would get up to speed. And so Juwanna Price and Holly Gentry and Detective Ray Tate left the station about 6 p.m. and headed to the apartment complex. Holly and Juwanna rode together. Detective Tate followed. Once he arrived at the destination, he radioed to dispatch the address. And just before he exited the vehicle, he thought about checking in with the jail. He asked the dispatch to reach out and see if a Larry Price had been brought in. But he wasn't there. Detective Tate got out and he shined his flashlight around, looking for anything odd and out of place. But he wouldn't be able to shake this feeling in his gut that something was wrong. That feeling would be reassured just minutes later, unfortunately. Detective Tate knocked on the apartment door and got no answer, which was odd. He just watched Holly and Juwanna enter, and the lights were turned off. Also odd because they just entered. He found the door unlocked and opened it and reached a hand in for a light switch. Once he clicked the lights on, he was greeted by a pistol being pointed right at his face. Thomas Simmons wasn't anticipating this little makeshift party. He'd come back to the Price's apartment to wait for Juwanna to get rid of her because she had seen his face that morning. He knew he needed to tie up this loose end, but now his predicament has changed. He looked down to see that this second man was a police officer. With his gun still raised, he took Detective Tate's weapon and his handcuffs and he signaled to the couch. Already seated there were Juwanna and Holly. Both appeared to be restrained. At this point, all the three hostages could hope for was that Detective Poncho was going to be at the apartment at any moment. But would he? Because he and Tate were going to catch up back at the station when he got out of his meeting. Thomas Simmons knew that they couldn't just wait around the apartment too long, so he decided to move everyone. Holly, Tate, then he and Juwanna would follow out the door. He kept his pistol on Juwanna and threatened her life if anyone tried anything. As they walked the detective's car, Ray Tate was trying to figure out how to get them out of that situation. Holly and Detective Ray Tate, both still restrained, had been instructed to lay flat in the back seat's floorboards. Thomas Simmons was driving and he had Juwanna up front with him. He was holding her head down in his lap with the gun laying in between them, next to them. The two men were trying to be as quiet as possible since every time they made a sound, Thomas threatened to shoot Juwanna. And the two men were just trying to figure out how to get at least one of them free. It was too difficult, though. There was not enough room behind the driver's seat with the two men large, you know, they're bigger guys, smushed on top of each other. They just had to wait and see what happened next. Holly prayed. He was a good Christian man with strong beliefs. As the car went over different surfaces, smooth road, and then a gravel surface, it came to a stop. It was pitch black out.
Probably took him to the same place he took Larry.
I thought that too at first. Thomas pulled the men out by their feet and laid them on the cold ground. There was no begging, no trying to reach a compromise. Neither men spoke. And just like he did with Larry Price, Thomas Simmons pulled up each man's collar up past their necks and shot them one time in the back of the head.
See, I'm not letting him restrain me to begin with. Like, you're either going to have to kill me now or you know, we're going to fight. But I'm not letting you tie me up because mm-hmm. that's the only outcome right there is he's going to shoot me in the back of the head.
Without hesitation, two more lives were taken. Juwanna was next. She had no fight in her. She was terrified. All she wanted to know was, where was Larry and was he dead? And Thomas lied to her, said he's alive and waiting for her at Thomas's house, but she must have known better. What she couldn't anticipate was the horror that she was about to go through. She knew she was going to be killed, but she never thought she'd be raped first.
I was about to say all for a damn car, but he obviously wanted something else too.
They always do. It's never just one and done. While everything is happening at the Price apartment, Detective Poncho had returned from his meeting. He and Detective Tate had agreed to meet back up at the station. He saw that Tate's desk was empty, and he didn't spot him in the station anywhere. He asked for the address for his partner's last known location from dispatch and headed out. Maybe there was a misunderstanding between the two men, like Poncho was supposed to meet him at the apartment, not back at the station. Would he stumble on something that Detective Tate came across? Like, is there something important that Tate found while he was at the apartment? But the thing was, Ray Tate would have called. He's that guy. If something would have come up or plans would have changed, he would have notified someone.
It was already dark and everything by then, right?
Mm-hmm. Detective Poncho reached the parking lot of the apartments and didn't see Tate's car. A little puzzled and a bit concerned, he headed back to the station.
He didn't go inside and look or anything?
He was just going to keep busy and wait for something from either dispatch or Tate himself. And as he's sitting at his desk, his phone rang. But it wasn't who he expected. It was Burl Price, who was Larry's father. And he didn't sound well. He went on to tell the detective that Juwanna had called him and his wife earlier asking about Larry, and she told them that she didn't know where he was. And this sparked worry in the Prices. Both of Larry's parents drove to Fort Smith from Lamar, which is like an hour away. Larry's parents were going to meet Juwanna at the apartment. But when they got there at 6:30, nobody was home. They went to a neighbor and asked to use the phone to contact the police. To their surprise, the receptionist said that there should have been a Detective Tate with Juwanna and Holly Gentry at the apartment at that time. This obviously caused more alarm. So Larry's parents called Juwanna's parents, and now they were at the neighbor's apartment, sitting, waiting to hear something. Juwanna's parents live in Flat Rock, which is like right there at Lamar.
I'm glad the Thomas guy didn't go back to the apartment again.
Right? Yeah. Learning this, Detective Poncho jumped back in his car and headed to the apartments. The last time, Poncho had just driven by looking for Tate's car, and that was at 7:30 p.m. This time, he pulled in and saw that there was this big brown truck parked in front of the complex, but it wasn't in a spot. It was like horizontally across a couple of them, which was strange. Detective Poncho would later learn that that was Holly Gentry's truck. He gets out of his car and he walked to the door of apartment number one, which was the Prices, and he saw that the door wasn't completely shut.
With the, Holly's acting like he owns the place.
Well, he does, so. With his gun at the ready, he pushed the door open. He called out to anyone but there was no answer. One of the first things that he noticed were two coffee mugs. These must have been the two that Juana mentioned in her report. She said that Larry was such a welcoming guy and offered this mystery man a cup of joe. Then he saw a large flashlight on the table next to them.
Better bag it and tag it.
He knew that that flashlight belonged to his partner, Tate. Nothing seemed to be out of the place in the apartment with the exception of the phone being pulled out of the wall. He didn't see any paperwork lying around, which is why the three of them even went to the apartment. This told Pancho that they were met with possible foul play and never got a chance to even look at the car's paperwork. He called the station from another apartment to update them on his findings. He didn't dare use the radio in case whoever had the three of them was still in Tate's car.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Mm-hmm. He probably is. Smart.
Then he had to bear the bad news to both sets of parents that this was looking like a kidnapping. The news of a missing Fort Smith detectives and two, well, honestly, three civilians spread like wildfire in the police department surrounding the city. All patrol officers were informed to look for Detective Ray Tate's 1978 light blue Ford LTD and Holly Gentry's 1979 silver and maroon Ford LTD. Unknown to Thomas Simmons, police forces from cities and county sheriff's departments were desperately looking for not just two vehicles connected to him, but also him. The only advantage he had was that no one knew who he was, just that he was some mysterious man that visited the Price's apartment to look at a car. Thomas pulled up to a convenience store near the Union 76 truck stop, which is outside Van Buren. He asked the clerk if taxis came out that far, but she wasn't certain, but probably not, especially because it was late. It was like 9:30 at night. He decided to give his sister, Leona Powell, a call and asked if she could come pick him up. It would take her about 20 minutes to drive from her home in Kibler to this truck stop outside of Van Buren. Thomas was staying with his sister since being released from prison. He was...
Don't mind Falco.
He was paroled after 8 years instead of serving an intended 45, and I will get to that later. He'd been doing well since being paroled in October. He was working at Arcola Sand and Gravel Company. Thomas was scheduled to work that very day, January 5th. He called in stating that he was in a car wreck, but he would try to be in the next day. Thomas was liked fairly well at his job. He was a tough guy. He had one of the, I love this, SLJs, which stand for shitty little jobs at the company. But he didn't complain. The foreman at the quarry knew that he needed to find a job to please his probation officer. Plus, his paycheck went to helping his sister out. She was a single mom with five daughters, one of which was actually Thomas's biological daughter that she took in. A couple hours after the descriptions went out on the wire, in the parking lot of the movie theater located at Central Mall in Fort Smith was a silver and maroon LTD. Just parked there, no damage to it. Minutes after it was spotted, a whole team, including Detective Pancho, arrived to inspect the vehicle. It had been 14 hours since anyone had seen this car, and all the men were holding their breath as they opened the trunk. Everyone was waiting to see if the body of Larry Price was inside, but all they found was a spare tire. The car was towed and processed immediately. Close to midnight, less than 2 hours later, a Van Buren officer spotted a light blue LTD at Union 76 truck stop outside of Van Buren. The officer noticed that it was covered in dust and dirt like it had never been washed before. The officer then radioed in for requests for a spare key. Detective Pancho rushed like hell to that truck stop. He knew it was his partner's car. He could see Detective Tate's glasses were inside as well as his notebook. He did see that there was a matchbook with the words good value on it. He was a bit confused by the condition because it was as clean as a whistle when he saw it at the station hours earlier. It too was transported for processing. One of the things that was looked at first was the mileage. Detective Tate's previous mileage was recorded at the station. Now there were 57 miles added to that. So officers and Poncho pulled out a map, drew a circumference. Ray, Joanna, and Holly had to be somewhere within that area. Poncho was just hoping that his partner was able to leave some kind of clue wherever that car had ended up. Moving on to the next day, Tuesday. So all that is Monday the 5th. That's a lot in one day. Tuesday morning, Thomas Simmons showed up to work, just like he said when he called the day before.
I would have thought he would have skipped town.
Yeah, me too.
Crazy.
He is on one. His butt is so poofy.
You good? Oh, he's frozen.
It was 6 a.m. and he went right to his duties. No one even brought up the wreck or asked him about it or if he was okay. After him only working a few hours into his shift, he requested a break to run a couple errands. He said it had to do with his car because of that so-called wreck. But in actuality, now he's not going to do it because he tried to record him.
Shake it off.
But in actuality, he was running back down to the closest branch for a Citizen Bank, which is the same bank that he went to just 24 hours prior. He went up to a teller and told her his name and that he had deposited a check the day before, and he had reason to believe that it wasn't going to clear. The teller asked for all his banking information. Then she wasn't sure about the protocol, so she asked who wrote him the check. And I hope her face was like stone, steel, because Thomas Simmons told her that the check was from Larry Price, and she instantly recognized the name. Larry's name, as well as his wife's and Holly Gentry and Detective Ray Tate's, had been all over the news, in the paper, on TV.
So it was a damn it Eugene moment for sure. Yes.
The teller played it cool, stating that she had to go ask questions about how to get the check back. What Thomas didn't know was that this person the teller was going to ask, Wanda Hicks, was married to the assistant police chief of Van Buren.
Wow.
When the teller went to tell Thomas that it would take a few days for the check to return, Wanda was watching, waiting for the man to leave so she could get the license plate number of his car. As soon as he walked out, she ran, wrote it down, called her husband, and assistant chief Wayne Hicks said, "Honey, I think you just solved a kidnapping and possible murder case."
Dude.
Assistant Chief Hicks contacted Fort Smith PD and relayed the information. And when they ran the name and the plates, they saw that this Thomas Simmons had quite a rap sheet. He had a past full of troubles, including multiple theft charges, attempted robbery with a firearm, and assault. The worst thing that he had done up to this point was in September 1970, he was in Little Rock and he robbed a gas station and took the 17-year-old worker as a hostage. He wanted to let the boy go, but he felt like everywhere he looked there was police and he knew the boy could ID him. So Thomas took him into a wooded area in Saline County where he tied him up and stabbed him multiple times and slit his throat.
He only got 8 years for that?
He left the boy for dead, but by some miracle he survived. Despite his actions, Thomas Simmons was let out in 8 years for good behavior.
Psh, I don't care how good your behavior is.
They were able to figure out where Thomas Simmons worked, and Van Buren officers went to an Arcola location in Van Buren, and then Fort Smith officers went to a location in their city. They would find him at the Fort Smith location, which was off of Jenny Lind. And if that clicks any... No. Okay. Jenny Lind was actually where Charles Ray Vines would find his victims 12 years later.
Ugh.
Isn't that... Ugh. Yeah, that's kind of quinky-dink. Thomas was polite and agreed to go with the officers to the station. He was read his rights. He agreed to let them search his 1975 yellow Toyota Celica. The first thing and the only thing he talked about was the check that Larry Price, quote unquote, wrote him. Thomas said that he met Larry Sunday, January 4th, at a drugstore at Central Mall, which, if you remember, that's where Holly Gentry's car was located. Thomas said that Larry wrote him a check for $350 for some drugs, like marijuana and Quaaludes.
Come on.
Thomas didn't have them on his person and was going to meet back up with Larry to deliver them. Then Sunday night, Thomas just happened to be at Union 76 truck stop and ran into Larry. And Larry was so glad to see him because he forgot that that check that he wrote was from a closed account. And this story lacked any sort of sense. If you received a check from someone who told you it was bad, would you try to deposit the next day and then the day after that try to go get it?
Damn it, Eugene.
Damn it, Eugene. When the officers tried to mention the kidnappings, he shut it down by asking for a lawyer, but luckily they were able to hold him on a parole violation charge. As Larry was talking with officers, there were others looking in his vehicle. They found a matchbook with the words good value in the front seat, so the same pack that was in Detective Tate's car. His trunk had some interesting items. There was clothing, a hacksaw, a knife, size 10 muddy boots, work glove, zip ties, flashlight, and just a box of miscellaneous trash.
What could those zip ties be used for?
That 20 or so minute drive from where Larry was currently sitting in a jail cell in Kibler, a secret was being discovered. It was after lunchtime when, I love this name, Clyde, when Clyde McClure and his nephews were out on their farmland checking on the equipment. Clyde was returning to his truck when he spotted blood. Initially, he thought his dogs had gotten a hold of some poor critter. He didn't pay it much attention. He was carrying some tools out of his truck, passing back by the area where the blood was, but from this angle, he saw what looked like the wrist and hand of a person. He looked around the piles of trash and old equipment parts and yelled to his nephews to call the police. He had just found three bodies.
I didn't know if you were going to say Larry or the three bodies.
Mm-hmm. Police from Crawford and Sebastian counties arrived.
I didn't figure this guy would try to, like, bury him or anything. He probably just left him out there since it was three bodies.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
The kidnapping happened in Fort Smith, which was Sebastian County. The bodies were found in Kibler, which is Crawford County. Hopefully the two would play well together, which they should. They have the same goal in mind, find and convict the man who did this to not only two innocents, but one of their brothers in blue. The discovery of the bodies was something seen in horror movies. They were stuffed into a large tractor tire, and then oil drums had been placed in front of them and on top of them to conceal them. The first body removed was Holly Gentry. Detective Ray Tate was next, who was handcuffed with his own cuffs. Juwanna Price was last.
When did they find it? Just a couple days later?
The next day.
Oh, wow.
The very next day. Juwanna Price was last. Under her body was a .38 special Colt Cobra 6-shot with a 2-inch barrel.
He left the gun there, too?
The serial number was filed off.
Still, he's not that bright.
Detective Tate's gun was not located at the scene, nor was his badge. Don't forget, we're still missing one person. The first victim in this horrible incident, Larry Price. The fact that his body wasn't with the others meant that he was killed and left somewhere separately, leading police to believe that these deaths were part of a cover-up that went wrong. Right.
No shit.
Officers checked every lead, every tip that came in. They were out canvassing, and they were able to find a few witnesses that said they saw a man matching Thomas Simmons' description near the apartments. One man said Larry Price, and a man with thinning hair and sideburns looked at Holly's LTD Monday morning. A taxi driver stated that he gave a ride to a man similar in appearance to Thomas Simmons from a drugstore at Central Mall to the Glen Holly Apartments around 6 p.m. Monday. The maintenance man for Phoenix Village Mall was cleaning the parking lot around 4:30 p.m. on the 5th. He saw a yellow car parked not too far from Joanna's car. A man with sideburns was in the driver's seat looking at the orange Maverick. It made him uneasy, so he wrote down the license plate number IFS053. The maintenance man had no idea the importance of that plate number, not until later when he heard about the kidnappings on the news.
Good for him, though.
Mm-hmm. He was very proactive. The bodies of Holly, Joanna, and Ray were transported to the medical examiner's office in Little Rock. The autopsies were performed by our, I guess you could call him our favorite, medical examiner.
The infamous Fahmy Malik.
That's right. He did the autopsies Wednesday morning, just hours after the bodies had been recovered. Dr. Malik determined that the deaths for the three was a contact gunshot wound to the back of the head.
Well, he got one right for once.
I knew you'd say something. The bullets were taken out but destroyed from the impact to the skull. They looked like they could have come from the .38 found underneath the bodies, but they could not prove that. There were no drugs or alcohol in their systems. The men did not suffer from sodomy. Joanna, however, was raped both vaginally and anally. Her body suffered post-mortem wounds, likely from an animal. All three showed bruising around their wrist. Ray Tate had the most bruising, likely due to him fighting back and being handcuffed tightly.
Dang, you think an animal got to him that quick?
Clyde thought one of his dogs chewed up a bunny. So if there's animals running around his farm in his field.
Oh, yeah. True.
Dr. Malik estimated the time of death after 5 p.m. on Monday the 5th. Prosecuting attorney Ron Fields, who was currently in the middle of his own investigation into the
State and Family murders.
Yep. He had the responsibility to go after Thomas Simmons for the kidnappings and murders of Holly, Joanna, and Ray.
What was his name again?
Ron Fields.
Yeah.
He really wanted to delay some because he knew in his gut, just like the police did, that Larry Price was also dead. He wanted to be able to go after Thomas for his death, but they hadn't found Larry yet. And it was just like the heavens heard him and opened. The deputy sheriff of Crawford County, who is Bill Grill, love that name.
These are great. At least they're easy to pronounce this time.
I know. He was just getting home Wednesday night after a long day of searching and interviewing, and his phone rings. It was a juvenile probation officer. He said that his brother had come home drunk, and he was rambling about seeing a mannequin or something at Clear Creek Park. The deputy sheriff drove to meet the brothers, who directed him to the recreational area of the park. And it was dark and it was eerie and there were shadows coming off the tables and the trees.
But there wasn't no mannequin. God.
Bill Grill pulled out his flashlight and he scanned the area. And he barely got out of his car when he spotted the so-called mannequin. Just like you've heard on the famous Crime Junkie podcast, it is never a mannequin. It was a body, and it was Larry Price. He was on his back with his head nearly in Ozark Lake, which is there at the park. It's a popular spot to fish. It's a great place to launch your boat. Or, you know, used to be until this area got tainted, as you can imagine. For the second time in 24 hours, law enforcement officers from the different counties came back out. The body and the evidence was collected. Larry Price was sent to Little Rock to be autopsied. Larry was found in the clothing that Joanna had stated in her missing persons report 2 days prior.
You know, they really got lucky that they found the body so fast.
They did.
Because it could have been 2 months, 3 months, and
I agree.
They'd all be decomposed, and it would have just lessened their chances of getting Thomas, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Malik made similar conclusions, just like he did with the three previous victims. Larry was shot once in the back of the head. His blood was negative for alcohol and drugs, and he had bruising around his wrists.
Consistent with zip ties?
He didn't say all that. Not in the book, at least. The first thing that Judge John Holland, who was going to be presiding over this case, the first thing that he did was to make sure all the T's were crossed and I's were dotted. He had Thomas Simmons evaluated to make sure he was sane. Right? That's smart. It was determined that he had antisocial personality disorder, but that did not affect his reasoning.
Yeah, because they just come back afterwards with an appeal saying he was insane.
Yeah, exactly.
Insane, yeah.
Prosecutor Ron Fields was going to charge Thomas Simmons with capital murder in Crawford County and charge him with kidnapping in Sebastian County. Thomas Simmons' attorney attempted to have the trial moved elsewhere, but it was denied. Thomas Simmons had disrupted the simple and quiet lives of the residents in Kibler, Fort Smith, and Van Buren. It didn't take long for the media to start digging into Thomas's life, made him headline news. There were some that doubted one person was able to kidnap and kill four people.
If he's got a gun on him, then it would be a lot easier.
Yeah. The person that they would have thought would have been his accomplice in this whole ordeal had a rock-solid alibi.
Oh, so you're saying they thought that there was a partner involved?
Right. But the partner they assumed...
Who was it? Just
I'll introduce him in just a second.
Okay.
Just a little passover with him because he's not that important. The murder trial of Thomas Simmons started on August 5th, 1981 at the Crawford County Courthouse in Van Buren. The trial would last 14 days. Thomas Simmons' defense was from the public defender's office, and they would have their word cut out for them. Prosecutor Ron Fields was a great storyteller. His opening statement was in present tense, being told to the jury like it was a play being acted out in front of them. And he didn't skip a beat. He didn't leave one thing out. The public defender's office tried doing the same-ish. They were going to try and make the point that Thomas didn't do these things and that his only real crime was forging a check from Larry Price.
I'm surprised they didn't just go for a plea agreement.
The defense kept saying Tom, not Thomas, to make it sound like he was just some hardworking, everyday man. Like, you would call your friend Tom, not Thomas. Like, it's not a formal thing, so they're trying to make him like a buddy-buddy in their eyes. Prosecutor Fields used the facts and eyewitness as well. He even pointed out that the gun found under Holly, Joanna, and Ray happened to be reported stolen, and this is like a mouthful right here, so hold on, by the boyfriend of Thomas Simmons' daughter's mother. This was the same man that everyone assumed helped Thomas in the crimes. But again, he had a solid alibi. He was hunting with buddies in Mississippi. The defense did make a good point. They asked, what about Thomas's clothing? There would have been blood on his clothing, and they weren't wet and they weren't muddy when Thomas stopped at the convenience store by Union 76 truck stop.
He could have changed into
right. He had
Larry's clothes. Who knows?
He had clothing in his trunk, so.
Or, I could see where he didn't get blood on him, too.
Yes, I'm going to mention that in
because he lifted the shirt,
yes.
The jackets over
yes.
him to shoot him, so.
You and Miss Anita were on the same page
yeah,
with that.
Yeah, the splatter wouldn't have hit him.
Good job, love.
Thanks.
You're getting good at it. Closing statements were given. The jury was sent off to deliberate. They were gone for 2 hours and 45 minutes. The jury found Thomas Simmons guilty of capital murder for each victim, Larry and Joanna Price, Holly Gentry, and Detective Ray Tate. The jury also decided that Thomas Simmons would be put to death by electrocution. The state, however, would never have the pleasure of putting Thomas Simmons to death. He would wrap himself in a blanket and slit his throat with a piece of metal he fashioned into a knife in 1991.
Dang.
Fun fact, while in prison, Thomas Simmons was the cellmate of Eugene Perry, the man that Jesse told us about in episode 54.
Really?
Isn't that crazy?
Small world. Damn it, Eugene.
Eugene Perry was found guilty in the murders of Kenneth and Suzanne Staten. At the end of the book, Anita Paddock gives her 2 cents. And I can see what she saw. 3 things that she mentioned stuck with me. First was what we just mentioned. Where was the blood spatter? But like Jesse said, pull up high enough, it'll be blocked. That was good.
The jackets, yeah.
Yep, the collars would block everything. Second thing that she points out is this John, the man that Thomas Simmons was going to sell Holly's car to. She thinks that he was involved. She thinks that this John character met up with Thomas after he kidnapped Holly, Juana, and Ray. Thomas killed the men while John raped Juana.
I was curious about the police car and then the other car. How did they both end up in 2 different places? So that's what made me think it was another person involved.
So I'm going to mention one of them in just a sec. Well, both, but one will answer your question. After John raped Juana, Thomas then did it and then he killed her. The men ended up at Union 76, the truck stop, in Tate's car, and then parted ways. Remember, Thomas called his sister. She picked him up. Somehow, John found his way back into town, and he was en route to pick up the LTD from Central Mall, Holly Gentry's car. But by the time he got there, the police had already found it.
Gotcha.
And the reason that it ended up at the mall was it was dropped off there, and then the taxi driver took Thomas back to the apartments.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing that Miss Anita goes on a little rant about, and I think this one's a little more far-fetched, but you can tell me, love, is that she doesn't think that Thomas killed himself. She thinks it was Eugene Perry because he had ties to the Dixie Mafia and he was ordered to kill Thomas for some reason. Because if you're going to slit your throat, why would you wrap yourself up to keep warm in a blanket?
That's true.
I get it, but I think that one's a little more far-fetched.
I'd have to see how he was wrapped up in a blanket to...
I agree.
...to really make my opinion on that one.
Detective Ray Tate was 33 years old when he was laid to rest. He left behind a wife, Anita Ruth, a son, Charles, and a daughter, Christina. He was a great man, missed by many. He assisted his community to the best of his ability, and though it was before our time, we thank Ray for his service, giving his life to serve and protect. Holly Gentry was 27 years old when he was laid to rest. His service was held at Faith Assembly of God in Fort Smith. It was packed with friends and family, and even more were watching on a television screen in a closed gym. There was up to almost 1,000 people paying respects to this man. There was not a doubt in anyone's mind that Mr. Gentry did his best to save his friend, the detective, and himself. Larry and Juana Price were only 21 at the time of their deaths. They were laid to rest side by side. The tombstone had 2 hearts interlocked to represent them. On the back of the tombstone was the letter Juana wrote Larry on their wedding day. Justice, I'm almost done. I'm almost done. It reads, "I waited so long for your love. It seemed like 1,000 years, but you finally came along. You wiped away all my tears. Now, today is the beginning of a life that we can share. Just take my hand and walk with me. Together we'll climb to touch the sky. We have a home where love will be our guide. Together we are not separate. We'll be as one until the end, and God will be our leader as our new lives begin." And that is the story of the kidnappings and murders of Larry and Joanna Price, Holly Gentry, and Detective Ray Tate. Thank you, Miss Anita Paddock, for caring to share their story and doing a great job covering the details and remaining respectful to everyone involved.
Her research and investigative work is so good.
So good. That's why I want to get those other two books by her and look into them.
Add them to the cart.
Tink, tink.
Already? You already had them on there.
They're there. And they're on the Kindle, so.
Well, good job, love.
Thank you.
That wraps up today's episode. You'll hear from us again next week. I'm still deciding on if I want to finish my book or start another.
He's not going to read that book.
That I saw. He's not going to finish it. I was like, oh, this one's interesting too. So we will see. But until next time, stay local, shop local,
murder local.